Thanks, Felix and Nick, for the invitation to speak. Can you all hear me all right? And you see my mouse moving about? Great. It's a pleasure to give this talk. Too bad that I guess we can only get together virtually. I chose a bit of a funny topic for this talk. I mean, partly because Felix asked for it, hoping that I could make a connection to quantum information. I'll try to do so in the talk. There's a lot of QI related stuff going on in Waterloo. I mean, like sort of from the high energy and condensed matter side of things to, you know, sort of the real quantum information. So this is sort of a work that also has connection to Waterloo. And so I highlighted Rafael Oliveira here on my slide. I'm not sure if he's in the talk. I mean, he need not be because he's one of the co-authors for this work. It also connects to sort of other work that's going on at the University of Waterloo by Lapchi Lau and friends, sort of in optimization. And sort of a nice mix of things, sort of relating tensors, ideas from optimization theory, sort of convex, but not in the usual sense, convex optimization, and invariant theory, which are sort of all things that I like. So what I want to do is basically give you an overview of the sort of circle of problems. Here is the rough summary. So it turns out that there's sort of an interesting set of problems that originate in invariant theory. So they have, you know, they can be viewed as geometric problems. They can be viewed as algebraic problems. What's surprising, though, is that it seems that they are amenable to numerical optimization, sort of tools that, you know, maybe are not traditionally associated with algebraic problems. Okay, and these are optimization problems that one could phrase as, it's about the optimization of functions that are defined in groups. So particularly, these will be continuous groups, and so the space will be manifolds. It will not be Euclidean space, which makes it interesting. And so, roughly speaking, what are these geometric problems called like? So we'll talk about them in much detail, but I will often refer to them as marginals or scaling problems. So you could think about the problem of, you know, finding matrices with prescribed row and column sums. This would be a classical marginal problem. You could think about the problem of finding quantum states that have prescribed reduced density matrices. This would be a quantum marginal problem. So that's sort of one side of things. And then the scaling problem would ask you to find an actual matrix of this form, sort of to actually go there and not just, you know, decide, can it be done or not? And then on the other side, there's, for example, something called a null cone problem, which is maybe not very familiar to many of you, but I'll explain. And that's really an algebraic problem, at least on first glance, from invariant theory. And we'll find that all these problems are related and that they're amenable to optimization. And I already mentioned some instances of the following sentence, but sort of the point and why we'd like to study them is that these strange problems sort of pop up in quite a wide range of applications, okay, from sort of, you know, problems that evolve from areas that are maybe obvious like algebra, but also, to analysis, computer science, complexity theory, theoretic questions, and quantum information, okay. And so what I want to do in this talk, time permitting, is to give an introduction to this framework. So this will sort of be from a general point of view. So it may be somewhat abstract if that's the first time some of you are thinking about these ideas. We'll sort of switch gears in some sense and discuss a panorama of applications. So this will be very concrete. I will not sort of maybe in detail explain how it fits into the framework, but you'll sort of see how this framework connects to many interesting applications. And then we'll sort of zoom into one, which is related to this quantum marginal problem that many of you know, and we'll discuss about an algorithmic solution based on these ideas. And we'll try to put them back into the more general context of, you know, these marginal scaling problems. So that's the plan. Okay. And you could think of this talk, you know, if you're algebraist, you might think about we're trying to do computation invariant theory without computing invariants. That's sort of one spin. But otherwise, sort of, you know, if it comes sort of more from the side of, you know, optimization and symmetries, this is sort of work on a class of optimization problems that have, you know, sort of a strong like a rich set of symmetries which we manage to exploit in this work. So that's the pitch. Okay. So why symmetries? So why group actions? So, you know, of course, group actions, I mean, as we all know, and some of us like, are a mathematical way of modeling symmetries and notions of equivalence. Okay. So for example, if I have two graphs, right, there's a natural group acting, the permutation group on the set of vertices. And I can use this, right, to state the problem, you know, to define when two graphs are isomorphic or equivalent. Okay. And there's a natural problem then that arises, and that is, how can we algorithmically and hopefully also efficiently check when two mathematical objects are equivalent? And so these are often interesting problems and, also often difficult ones. For example, for graph isomorphism, despite the recent breakthroughs, we do not yet know polynomial time algorithms. Another example that can be put into this framework usefully is, to think about, say, suppose you have matrices, and you say, two matrices are equivalent if you can go from one matrix to the other by row and column operations. Then we know, this, you can go from one to the other and back if and only if they have the same rank. Okay. And so that's very, in this case, that's an example where we can easily check this problem, and not only, mathematically, but it's easy to compute the rank, right? We just do Gaussian elimination, and thereby even efficiently check equivalence of matrices. Now, if you ask the same problem for tensors, what would this problem be? It's what's the rank of a tensor? What's the minimal number of elementary rank one tensors that you need to write your state? Then this is a hard problem. Okay, we don't know how to solve it. Or we believe that we cannot solve it efficiently. So that sort of shows that, this sort of rich set of problems, some of them are easy, some of them are hard. And what we're trying to do is sort of carve out a little space that hopefully has efficient solutions and while still being interesting. Here's another problem. So suppose you have a polynomial, you could say, when is a polynomial equivalent to the zero polynomial? That is, when is it the zero polynomial? That seems like a trivial question. You just look at all the coefficients, are they all zero? Assuming the field is, say, infinite or large enough. Now, suppose you're given this polynomial though as a black box, and you can just evaluate it, right? And then it's a multivariate polynomial, and you're trying to figure out, is it zero or not? That's actually hard. I mean, it's easy to do randomly. You just pick a random point, high probability, P of X will be non-zero if P is not the zero polynomial. But to de-randomize this algorithm is hard and an interesting, a big open problem. Okay. And again, you can think of it as some kind of equivalence problem. Okay. We'll make more precise connection later. So and then on the side of mathematics, that's sort of course, related to computing normal forms of objects, like, for example, the normal form that you get by Gaussian elimination, or a Jordan normal form. It's related to describing modular spaces for those of us who like it, understanding invariants and so on and so forth. So this is some sort of high level motivation. Now, as stated, this is more of a meta problem. I somehow have to really, these four bullet points, they're quite vague, and now I have to be a bit more precise about the framework and the setup. So the scenario I want to consider, and that's sort of where the abstract part of the talk starts, is the following. So what I want to do is I want to fix some group. This group encodes my symmetries, okay? And I'll always take this to be a nice, continuous, what's called reductive subgroup of GLN. For concreteness, just think of this group as being GLN, SLN, the set of diagonal n by n matrices, which I will denote by Tn for T for torus, or products of those, okay? So for example, the group of invertible local operations would be like, and tuple that we like sometimes in quantum information would be just tuples of, say, GLNs. Okay. Now, such groups can act on vector spaces by linear transformations. That's called a representation. So we'll fix one of those. So V will be this vector space that we'll act on. And once I fix this data, right, so then I can talk about what's called the orbit of a vector. So what I'm doing is I'm taking my favorite vector V and I'm taking my favorite vector V, and then I'm acting on it by all group elements. And I use this notation G dot V for the result of applying a transformation G on a vector V. This thing is called the orbit. And then sometimes that, because our groups are usually not compact, this thing will not be closed. It would be nice to close it up, in which case we'd put a bar on it. Okay, so here's a very simple example. We'll have more interesting ones momentarily. Simple example, our group is just the non-zero complex numbers. This group acts on a two-dimensional complex vector space in the following way. Our complex number, or non-zero complex number, acts on vector xy by multiplying the first component by x and the second by, the first component by g and the second one by g inverse. Right? That's a nice group action.
We have a question in the chat, so I'll just read it out. The row and column operations problem you mentioned becomes hard if the same operations are done to each. This is a generalization of graph of isomorphism. Does this computational difference have anything to do in general with these different types of group actions, left-right multiplication action versus conjugation?
That's an interesting point. I didn't appreciate, but it makes sense what you say. I mean, in general, so I'll just, well, on this very slide and in 1 minute, I'll define, you know, sort of the basic problem given two vectors. Are they in the same orbit? Yes or no? And this is a hard problem, or like a difficult problem in general. And maybe we won't hope for polynomial time algorithms for this one. But we look at certain relaxations which turn out to be very interesting. And those we can hope to find efficient algorithms for, maybe even in generality, sort of in the class of situations that we are studying here. But it's a good question. In general, sort of the complexity of these problems will depend on the action on the group, and as you know, the type of the group, you know, say this finite group versus continuous group, and so on, as well on the exact representation that you're on, the exact action that you're studying. So, great question. I'll show you some examples where we can solve this efficiently, and others where we would like to have evidence that we can but do not yet know. Thanks. So let's just look at the simple example here. So, okay, G acts on a vector of length 2 by G in the first component, multiplication by G inverse in the second component. So I visualize these orbits on the right-hand side here. So for example, the orbit of the 1, 1 vector, right, it's sort of the form G inverse. So, you know, if you solve for X, you get this curve, like 1 over X squared. Similarly here, so that's part of the same orbit. The whole thing is complex, okay, so I'm giving you sort of a real slice. So that's sort of what the generic orbit looks like. But there's also degenerate cases. For example, if I look at the 1, 0 vector, its orbit will be the set of all all vectors of the form a non-zero number. The first entry is 0 and the second entry. So exactly the x-axis without 0. Okay. The 0 vector itself, it's its own orbit, right? Because because we act linearly, 0 never gets mapped to a non-zero number. And for example, also this vertical axis without the origin would be another orbit. Okay, so there's different kinds of orbits. And now I'll state the question again that I just mentioned. So once we've set up this kind of problem, right, we can sort of ask in a precise way, you know, when are two objects equivalent? And by this we mean, you know, for example, given two vectors, we can ask, are they in the same orbit under my group action? So for example, here, right, sort of, you know, any two points on this blue line, complex line, would be on the same orbit, but say blue and green would not be. Okay. Now, in general, that's sort of a subtle question, and it's a bit sort of non-robust because, as I was saying before, these groups are usually not compact, so these orbits are not compact or not even closed, and so it will be difficult to solve these problems. For example, by separating these problems by say invariant functions. Okay. So what turns out to be a useful thing to do and interesting for many applications is to look at more robust versions of this problem. So here's one, okay? And what I'm doing here is I'm closing one of these orbits. So I'm asking, you know, is V in the closure of, say, the orbit of W? Okay. So now it's sort of more robust. That's a closed object because I'm taking the closure. And you could imagine this is a bit like, you know, asking, can I approximate V, you know, by arbitrary transformations of W? So for example, this zero point, right, is in the closure of the green line, but not conversely. Okay. You could also ask a more symmetric question, and which is the following. Suppose you have two vectors, do their orbit closures intersect? Okay. So for example, the horizontal green line minus origin, and the vertical green line, well, the vertical line that would be green if I would have drawn a green without the origin, those do not, right? None is in the no point of one on sort of line is in the closure of the other because the origin is not in there, but they both, their closures intersect in the origin. Okay, so that's sort of a more symmetric notion of equivalence. And here's a very special case that turns out to be actually interesting, which is where I'm asking, suppose you have a vector V, can I just drive it all the way to zero in the limit by my group action? So that seems like a very simple problem, right? Sort of, you know, I mean, how hard can it be, right? I have a vector, I have a group, and I just try to make the norm as small as I want. I want to make the vector go all the way to zero. This is a special case of the preceding when, say, one of the vectors, say, well, I guess the notation is bad, this should be W. If this V is zero, then sort of both of these problems reduce to this one. And here, right, sort of if the answer is yes, then we say that V is in the null cone. Okay, that's somehow for historical reasons the way it's called. I guess the null cone because null is in the closure. What is that in our case? Well, zero itself is of course a null cone, but also the horizontal and the vertical axes are in the null cone. But these blue, these other orbits are not, right? So points on the other orbits are not because you see they have a finite distance to the zero, to the origin. So you cannot in the limit go all the way to zero, okay? So these are sort of fairly abstract and general problems. They're very classical. Some of them we know how to solve using invariants. It's not clear at this point why we would like to solve them. I hope sort of in 10 minutes or so that there will be more motivation. Usually invariant theory is very powerful and beautiful, but not very efficient in terms of computation. So while there are beautiful algorithms in computation invariant theory, they are not always or mostly not efficient and also in practice difficult to run. The point sort of this all is kind of trying to find numerical and algorithms that actually work well in practice and hopefully also in theory. Okay, so to some extent we know how to do this. I want to sort of focus right now. Well, okay, so I'll give you one other example that is very well known, and then I want to sort of focus on this Nullcon problem, and then we'll see later actually why even this very strange and simple problem pops up in some examples. So here is another example, right, that's a bit more complicated. So what we're doing here is we are having the group GLN act on n by n complex matrices by conjugation, okay? And in this case, we know that two matrices are in the same orbit, if and only if they have the same Jordan normal form. Okay, and so in particular, we can solve even this orbit problem, the very first problem I mentioned, right? We can just compute the Jordan normal form and then compare. Okay, now what about this more robust version? So, for example, if I have two matrices X and Y, I want their orbit closures to intersect. I want to find a common point that you can approximate both. By things in the orbit of X as well as by things in the orbit Y. It turns out the only real freedom that you have is in making these ones in the Jordan normal form as small as you like, because that's actually arbitrary, I guess, as we know. So it turns out that X and Y, if this intersect orbit closed, if and only if these eigenvalues with their algebraic multiplicity are the same. So the ones just don't matter for this problem. And therefore, finally, when is X in the null cone? That's the case when all these eigenvalues are zero, which is the case when our matrix is nilpotent. Okay, so that's another sort of very classical case where, it's sort of not trivial to solve the problem. Jordan normal form is a bit non-trivial, but we know how to do it. Okay, and that's sort of another example, and I guess those are sort of the maybe now we've done two examples that maybe you don't care about so much. I hope all the following ones will be interesting. Okay, so before going into this panorama of examples, though, I want to give you sort of the high level idea, sort of what the heck should optimization have to do with these orbit problems, okay? And for concreteness, I want to focus on this null cone problem because the connector is easiest to explain there. So the null cone problem, remember, was given a vector, can I go to the zero vector in the limit, by applying a sequence of group operations, okay? So in other words, is it a zero in the orbit closure, okay? And this problem is sort of, quite obviously, we can phrase as an optimization problem. We just pick a norm in our vector space, right? And we just seek to minimize or infimize the norm of, over the group. So I'm infimizing of all group elements G and capital G, the norm of the vector G applied to V, okay? And so clearly, if this infimum is zero, then zero is in the orbit closure. And if it's not zero, it's not in the orbit closure. Things are actually a bit more subtle because usually you like to sort of, the algebraists like to close things up in a different topology than we like to do with just norms. Turns out here there's no difference for non-trivial reasons, so we don't have to worry. So here's a picture, right? Somewhere on this line, there's this vector V. I'm drawing the orbit closure. And so how would I attack this optimization problem? So this minimization problem, maybe I just want to find a vector W that really has a minimal norm on the orbit, okay? And then, I just check, is this the zero vector or not? On the orbit closure, not on the orbit, okay? Now, whenever we have a minimization problem, the first thing we do is to check the first order condition. So we want to take the derivative and set it to zero. Okay. So clearly, we have a function that we want to minimize. It's a function defined on a group. Okay. Be that as it may, this is a nice manifold. Whenever we are at a minimizer, whenever we have a group element that minimizes this function, certainly the derivative should be zero, right, in all directions. So in other words, the gradient of this function should be zero. Gradient with respect to G, this group element. And maybe it's not super obvious. To many of you, it will be clear. These continuous groups, they have a nice tension space, right? And that's how what parameterizes the direction derivatives and so on and so forth. But if not, you can just think sort of intuitively about the gradient vector. And what's amazing is actually about this problem is that this is also sufficient. So you will always, so there's the only critical points are actually global minima of this function. So so as a consequence, instead of minimizing this norm, you can also try to set the gradient to zero. And that needn't have to be the case, and it is the case by sort of a beautiful result which you can finesse, and I'll sort of come back to the geometry that underlies this later. But if you believe that's the case, then we can equivalently try to approach this problem not only by minimizing the norm, but also by minimizing the gradient, right? Because setting the gradient to zero, that's now another way of solving the problem. Okay. And as it turns out, and I promise that you'll see so in a few slides, actually this gradient of this norm function is often an object of independent interest and maybe even of primary interest. So in many of the applications that we'll see, there is no natural norm that we might care about at the beginning. The problem is not stated in terms of norms, but it's stated in terms of gradients. And turns out these gradients, they will compute row and column sums, they will compute reduced density matrices, and so on and so forth. And so really we care about setting this gradient to zero or to some prescribed value. And the way we solve it is by actually finding basically this formulation in terms of minimizing norms and all this, sort of this framework, connecting to this framework. So that's sort of the point. Okay, so here's sort of a little summary of what we did so far. So we said we had some nice continuous reductive subgroup of GLN acting linearly on some vector space. We had this somewhat esoteric null cone problem. Can I drive my vector to zero or not? So here's a picture where we cannot. And then there's two ways, as I just explained, to approach this problem by an optimization, by sort of ideas from optimization, by an optimization approach. The first is by trying to just plainly minimize a norm. That's the first version here, right? So we would like to, given a vector, find a group element G such that the norm is close to the infimum. Sorry, this cap should just be the infimum of the norm function. I didn't define this, apologize. So we just want to minimize the norm. Or we could ask this dual problem, given a vector, find a group element such that the gradient is very small, sort of almost zero, okay? And this problem, for historical reasons, often called a scaling problem, and we'll see momentarily why this is a good name, okay? And I told you, but have not convincingly argued to you that these problems are equivalent, even their approximate versions, their quantitative versions. So if you can achieve this up to epsilon, this holds up to f of epsilon and vice versa, and we understand how. And it also turns out that if you can solve these problems with enough precision, you can actually solve the original problem if you cared about this one. Actually, in practice, sort of, many of us will mostly care actually about this version of the problem. Okay. In the spirit of these, orbit problems, these equivalence problems, it is interesting to note that actually this null cone problem, as specialized as it may seem, and these two relaxations actually provide maybe the only path that we know to solve these more general orbit problems as sort of a first step. And I can comment about this later for those of you who are interested. Okay, but so what I would like you to take away is basically that this problem is sort of a useful model problem. If we could solve this one, I think we would make great progress also towards other equivalence problems. We have some evidence that we can actually solve this in quite generality in polynomial time, which is great. But at the same time, even this null cone problem and its two relaxations connect to interesting applications. And that's what I would like to look at in the second part of my talk. Okay. I guess there's no questions in the chat. Just have a sit. Okay. So now I want to give you some applications, and I'll sort of start from scratch so you can forget everything about groups for now. And I'll briefly indicate and at a few moments how these examples relate to this general framework that we made before. But now I want to basically look at applications and examples, then really zoom into the quantum example, this about this margin problem, write down sort of a very concrete algorithm for this one, and then sort of zoom out again and come back to these general orbit problems. Okay, so here's some applications, and some of you may have seen some of these already. For example, if you have been in talks by Avi Wittgenstein or by Rafael Oliveira. Here is sort of a nice problem. It's called matrix scaling, matrix raking, iterative proportional fitting, and many other names. Let me describe the problem to you. suppose X is a matrix with non-negative entries. Okay, so you could imagine it to be a bipartite probability distribution. We say that a scaling of such a matrix is another matrix Y that is obtained by multiplying all the rows by some positive numbers AI and all the columns by some positive numbers BJ. Okay, so that's called, such a matrix is called a scaling of a matrix X. Now, we also know that a matrix called W is stochastic if its row and its column sums are equal to one. Okay. And now the question is, the matrix scaling question is, given a matrix X, does it have a doubly stochastic scaling? So can you, you know, rescale all the rows, rescale all the columns, such that the resulting object is doubly stochastic? If you think about this as a, you know, a probability distribution, it's a bit like making the marginal distributions uniform, right? And you could ask more generally, you know, do you want some prescribed row and column sums, you know, some prescribed classical marginal probability distributions? You might want to try to find them. Okay, and we'll be generous. We'll be interested in when can we solve this problem to arbitrary precision. Okay, so that's sort of a nice geometric or probabilistic problem. It has many applications. It's kind of comes from statistics. It has sort of interesting connections to complexity. It's used as preprocessing in numerical linear algebra. There's some nice combinatorics connection. And what is this combinatorics connection? Okay, it turns out that actually this problem has a positive solution for sort of to arbitrary precision, if and only if the following algebraic condition is true. Namely, if and only if the permanent of the matrix X is non-zero. Okay, because it's a matrix with non-negative entries, that means the permanent should be positive. Now the permanent is the same object, well, looks like it's defined like the determinant, but without the minus signs, right? Sum of all permutations and then the product of the corresponding matching or the corresponding entries of the matrix. Now, when is this permanent positive? Because there's no cancellations, there's no negative entries in the matrix. That's the case if and only if there exists a bipartite perfect matching in the support of the matrix, right? So if you think of a graph, a bipartite graph, the rows, there's n rows, n columns, these are like that, n and two n vertices, draw an arrow whenever, you know, the corresponding matrix entry is non-zero. Whenever this graph has a bipartite perfect matching, in other words, you know, there's sort of a permutation pi such that, you know, X sub I comma pi of I is non-zero for all I, then this problem can be solved, and that's if and only if, okay. And by permanents are usually tricky, actually this problem of determining whether this permanent is positive is not. And this problem can be solved in polynomial time. And actually we can even find these doubly stochastic scalings by a very nice and simple algorithm. And the algorithm is so nice that we can state in words, we don't even have to write it down. It basically, the observation is the following. It's very easy to make a matrix row stochastic, right? You just multiply each row by one over the row sum. That's the left multiplication. It's also very easy to make it column stochastic, just at the doing both at the same time is annoying. So what you do in this algorithm is you just do first, you normalize the rows, then the columns, then the rows, then the columns. You just continue, and magically this converges whenever it can convert, okay? So I have a little picture for you here. Okay, it's maybe it is nice to illustrate. So here's a matrix, 1, 2, 4, 0. There's a matching, so that's 4, 2, another support. And indeed, you know, we fix the rows, then we make, you know, make this 1 third, 2 thirds. Fixing the second row is very simple, 1, 0. Now we fix the columns, 1, 4, 3 fourths, 1, 0. We do this many, many times, and we see that somehow what this will converge to is the matrix 0, 1, 1, 0 in the limit of many steps. Okay, so this is sort of proof by example. Now, if you wanted to turn this into an actual proof, you would sort of need to show that you make progress all the time. And the way, the easiest way maybe to see this is to show that the permanent actually does not, you know, is not only non-zero when you can solve the problem, but actually the permanent of the normalized matrix increases in each of these steps. And because, you know, permanence of the set of sort of normalized matrices are, you know, it's like they have some maximum, some of this has to converge at some point. And okay, here's some pictures of permanent increases, distance being, you know, the deviation of the row and column sums from being doubly stochastic decreases. So that's what we want. Okay. Now, how is this problem related to our general framework? I'll just give you sort of a clue because the calculation is a bit too annoying for now. Well, clearly what we want to choose as our representation is the n by n matrices. What we would like to choose as our group is the thing that corresponds to this left and right multiplication. But we want to multiply by diagonal matrices, okay? So our group is pairs of diagonal matrices. And the group action, right, is just a pair G1, G2, X on V, left multiplying V by G1 and right multiplying V by G2. Remember, V is a matrix, right? So I can multiply it by diagonal matrices on the left and from the right. Now, these matrices, you know, both the matrices, these n by n matrices V, as well as G1 and G2, they have complex entries. So something is still wrong, okay? Because this problem was traced in terms of matrices with non-negative entries or with positive entries for these scalings. Okay. Happily, it turns out that the problem that we were interested in before was the problem of minimizing a norm, right? But if you minimize a norm of a matrix, then say the Frobenius norm, right? Then you will actually just sum the absolute value squares of the matrix. So it turns out that secretly this whole, all these norm minimization problems, everything, they only depend on the modulus square of all the numbers that are involved. And that's the non-negative matrices that are involved. So for example, if I just take the absolute value squared of all the entries of V, I get my matrix X and that makes one connection. And now the crucial point is the following, right? I told you before that, okay, the scaling problem is this problem of, you know, setting the gradient of the norm function to zero, or maybe setting it to some prescribed value. Here it turns out if you compute the gradient of this norm in the right coordinates, it computes exactly the row sums and the column sums of your matrix. Okay. So the gradient with respect to sort of the first n coordinates computes the row sums, the other one computes the column sums. Now, okay, I have to say, of course, what does it mean to compute the gradient with respect to say this group of complex matrices, right? So for this, maybe I want to write my matrices as e to the x for some number x, right? And then I can take an ordinary derivative. So that's kind of what's going in the background, but maybe that's not so important. But the point is sort of, very simple representation. This gradient, it has exactly a nice interpretation. It's actually the interpretation we care about that sort of started this whole matrix scaling problem. And solving this matrix scaling problem is exactly the problem, the equivalent to trying to set this gradient, say, to be the all ones vector. And if you worked, say, with a subgroup of determinant one matrices, it would just be making the gradient zero because you would lose this traces part, but that's sort of a detail. Are there any questions about this connection? I mean, to the extent that I explained it, I guess. All right, good. So here's another one that's a bit more quantum. It's called operator scaling in the community. It should probably be called super operator scaling. So the idea is you take a completely positive map, T of rho, okay, with cross operators xi, say n cross operators. Again, we are going to define a notion of a scaling. We'll define a scaling problem, and we'll explain sort of an algebraic interpretation of the same thing, which will be interesting. Okay, so how do we define a scaling of the super operator T? It's going to be another super operator S that is obtained from T by left multiplying all the cross operators by A, and right multiplying the cross operators by the same matrix B. I mean, the same matrix you use on the left, so on all the cross operators A, and you use B for all the cross operators when you multiply from the right. Okay, here's another way of writing it, right? So if you take your channel, you pre-compose it with BB dagger, you post-compose it with AA dagger. So that's a new super operator. We call it a scaling of the old one. And you may sort of, somewhat whimsically say that a channel is called, you know, quantum doubly stochastic if it's trace preserving in Yonetto. So that's sort of formally sort of the natural counterpart of what we did from matrices before. Okay. So T of I equals C dagger of the identity equals I. Okay. So a Yonetto quantum channel. Okay. So this is a problem that has been studied by Gerwitz, sort of, I think either in the same or in a related paper to actually where he studied the NP hardness of the entanglement problem. Which is funny. And so it's called the operator scaling problem. Given a super operator T and cross representation, try to find a doubly stochastic in this quantum sense scaling. That is, you know, find a pre and post compose left and right multiply the cross operators by some arbitrary matrices to make the whole thing a Yonetto quantum channel. That's the problem, okay, which one can study. It turns out it has a beautiful characterization just like before. So whereas in the matrix scaling case, it was all about the permanent, now things are a bit more complicated. It turns out there's a nice algebraic solution and it looks as follows. So it turns out that this problem can be solved to arbitrary precision if and only if there exist matrices Y sub K such that if you compute the determinant of the block matrix in some sense, you know, where you take any entry of these axes and you sort of, you put sort of the matrix yk in it, right? So in other words, this Kronecker product yk tends to xk all summed up, this object should have non-zero determinant. Okay. So, okay, fine. It turns out that when, that again, there's a nice algorithm, because just like for matrices, it's very simple to make a, you know, to scale a super operator to be unital. It's also easy to scale it to be trace preserving, but doing both is hard. So again, you can alternate, you can prove that things work out. It's now not so obvious what the right potential function or, you know, the right monotone should be under this process, but okay. This can be done. And so in this, you know, maybe now no longer so recent work by Ankit, Rafael, Avi, and Leonid Gerwitz, they showed how to solve this, that this procedure actually works. It can be analyzed. It can be done in polynomial time. Okay, so that was our first evidence that this class of problems I described before actually has deterministic polynomial time solutions. Okay. And by now, there's also nice algebraic algorithms that work over any field and whatnot. Okay. So now what's the point? Okay, so the point is that actually this algebraic problem is also quite interesting. Suppose I restricted these matrices YK to actually just be scalars, you know, just numbers. Then you, what you would have here is a linear combination of matrices XK of these cross operators. And you would ask, is there some linear combination such that the determinant is non-zero? Okay, so in other words, we have a symbolic matrix. You know, each entry of the matrix is a linear form. And we ask, you know, is such a matrix, you know, generically invertible or not? It turns out, so this problem is called it's an instance of the so-called polynomial identity testing problem. It's exactly of the form I described before. There's a polynomial, right, sending sort of these y's to this determinant. And again, we are thinking about the scalar case now, where it's just, you know, little yk times xk, scalar times matrix multiplication. And, you know, it's again, that's the problem that's super easy to solve deterministically. You just pick the numbers at randomly. You just pick the numbers of random. Deterministically, we don't know, is like a big open problem. And so one interest, you know, sort of orthogonal to anything about superoperators towards approaching this problem, one interest in this problem is that, you know, maybe we can learn something about this polynomial identity testing problem. And, you know, if I'm not sure if some of the operator algebraists are in the audience, but, you know, you could think of this as sort of evaluating a sort of, you know, you could think of this yk as sort of a non-commuting variable. You know, so you can think of a polynomial that's sort of a super, you know, like a sum linear combination of the xk's with non-commuting coefficients, and then saying such a matrix with non-commutative entries, such a polynomial matrix with non-commutative entries is invertible if and only. I mean, that's basically the definition of invertible. Okay, so that's sort of, so you can think of this as a non-commutative kind of polynomial identity testing. Okay, so these are two examples. There's many more. I will not read.
I have a quick question. Sorry. In the slide before, how much does the choice of the norm make a difference here?
Very good. So, I mean, for this null cone problem itself, of course, you know, it doesn't matter which norm we pick. So, I mean, they're all equivalent. If you ask about algorithms, then it's more important what, you know, what the norms look like.
And for the gradient, sort of, it would make a difference as well, right?
For the gradient, it would make a difference, exactly. That's a very good point. And I'm sweeping a lot under the rug. So actually, usually what we like to work with unitarity invariant norms that are invariant with respect to some nice unitary subgroup of the symmetry group. So for example, you know, we'll look. So here, the norm that we'll use is actually the Frobenius norm, which comes from the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product. So usually we like our norm to come from an inner product that is invariant, and then some of all these things have a nice formula. So that's a very good point. Now, if you just ask from the perspective, you know, how well do we want to approximate, then usually it's not so important, but sort of for indeed, like, yeah, defining grades and all these things, that's indeed a good thing to do, yeah. Cool. Thanks. Good point.
Another question?
Yep.
So Michael, can you say precisely what, again, the major open problem in QCF is?
So I guess it's sort of given a matrix whose entries are linear forms, so linear polynomials, okay. Determine if it's the if it's never invertible. It's never invertible. If its determinant polynomial is, so the determinant of this matrix will be polynomial, and decide if this is zero or non-zero.
Okay, so polynomial identity testing for a matrix of linear forms.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's basically. I mean, that would be quite the breakthrough. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
In deterministically, of course, yeah.
Right, exactly. Define a deterministic polytime algorithm for it.
Yeah.
Okay, and just a remark, like this PIT problem is equivalent to the first problem that Michael said, the determinant of any matrix is equivalent to any polynomial that you can compute. So that's why this is major. This is as general a problem as it gets.
So this is as general as just finding such a thing for polynomial identity testing?
Yes. Yeah,
I see.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, I mean, yeah, right. Good. Excellent. Okay. So this slide, I'll not go through. I'll sort of go to the even more quantum part now. I guess the point is there's sort of many more interesting applications, more applications that have also have a connection to Waterloo, both because of the problems and their solutions, right? There's this sort of this, there was this open problem about frames, approximate frames, Parseval frames, which had been resolved using similar methods. There's interesting connection to analysis. Some of you will know, for example, this Horn's problem, which asked about when the sums of Hermitian matrices and the eigenvalues. It turns out this problem also fits the framework. While we know to decide this in poly time, actually using algebraic algorithms, the only I think effective algorithms that I know of actually finding such matrices are via exactly the same techniques that I'm discussing in this talk. Okay. Recently, people have made connections to a maximum likelihood estimation for certain models and so on and so forth. So some of the problems that are on the slide, they relate right to the scaling problems. Other problems relate really to this norm minimization task. Happily, they're equivalent. Some have a more algebraic or sort of pure mathy flavor. But what's interesting is they all sort of fit this general framework that I sort of outlined on the first part of the talk. And therefore, it's really interesting to find general techniques and general algorithms. Okay, and so what I want to do now is I want to zoom into this quantum information part a little bit more, and also comment about the connection to tensor ranks that I mentioned in my abstract. And then maybe at the end, we'll have a sneak peek at some of these algorithms. All right. So this is the unnecessary slide in this audience. What is a quantum state? A pure quantum state is a tensor. If d particles say d tensor. Be represented by an object of unit norm. Quantum states have density matrices. You could define them in this fashion, or you could say it's the Gras matrix of a flattening of the tensor if you don't like quantum states. Once you set up this problem, there's this nice quantum, once you set up this framework, there's a nice problem known as the quantum margin problem, or here's a particular instance of it. That's sort of the single particle margin problem. And what it asks for is in the same sense that for a matrix, you could ask, what are possible row and column sums we can ask for tensors? What are possible reduced density matrices of multi-party quantum states? Okay. And one particular version of the problem looks at globally pure states and single particle, single body reduced density matrices. Okay. So, that's a problem. For historical reasons, I'm quite interested and I think it's quite beautiful. It's beautiful that we still cannot solve it as efficiently as we like. The pureness constraint is really important. If I didn't say pure, then of course the tensor properties of these rows would be the answer, but because things are supposed to be pure, sort of entanglement creeps in naturally by the mixedness of the margins, I think some are annoying, okay. Now, one simplification that we can make is we can observe that the answer to this problem does only actually depend on the eigenvalues of the rows, right? Because whenever I find a pure state, I can apply a local unitaries to it and I get another state that has the same eigenvalues of its reduced density matrices, but the eigenbase is changed. Okay, very good. Now here is sort of an easy example and an almost easy example. First one is suppose you only have two particles, right? Then we know Schmitt decomposition, reduced density matrices of A, reduced density matrix of B, they have the same non-zero eigenvalues. So that solves the problem in the bipartite case. How about the three-party case? Okay, it turns out in general, we don't have a nice closed form answer. Here's an example where we do know the answer. So that's for three qubits. So for three qubits, right, I have three one-body reduced density matrices. They have two eigenvalues, but the eigenvalue is summed to one, so I'm just plotting the largest eigenvalue for each. That fully characterizes the problem. So that's the largest eigenvalue of row one, of row two, and row three. It turns out they are not completely arbitrary. Okay, it turns out actually that there's linear inequalities. For example, the sum of any two can be at most the third plus one. Okay. So for example, if now one guy is one half, there's a constraint. The other two cannot be pure, right? So I guess that's intuitive, right? If like two of the three guys are pure, the last one also has to be pure if the global state is pure. So this makes this quantitative and it leads to these phases of the polytope. Okay, and one can prove this very hands-on by the variational principle. what's not at all obvious is that in general, you always get linear inequality as constraints, okay? And so I'll explain this in a moment, but before explaining this, I want to make the problem, you know, a bit richer again. So we spoke about these scaling problems all the time. There's no scaling in this problem, so we have to add on. So we have to define what we mean by scaling of a quantum state, a pure quantum state of a tensor. Okay. And naturally, you know, an analogy to what we did before, of course, scaling of a quantum state X, of a pure state X, is just another quantum state where we apply local invertible operations to it. So, right, that sort of generalizes what we did before for matrices and for quantum channels, for superoperators. Okay. This one has this nice, you know, semi-nice operation interpretation in terms of SLOCC, which we know is characterized by this SLOCC equivalence, so stochastic post-selected LOCC. And so in this sense, we could ask, you know, we could basically interpret this question as, you know, scaling is, well, anything, yeah, anything of, we can produce by SLOCC from sort of this reference state X. So X is sort of fixing the entanglement class in the sense of SLOCC. And we can now ask the slightly more complicated questions, which marginals can arise, which reduced density matrices can arise from scalings of a given tensor or pure state X, right? So for example, right, we could ask an analogy to what we did before, when can we take a given tensor and make it such by SLOCC, convert it into another tensor or pure state, such that all the run-body reduced density matrices are uniform or maximally mixed? That is, you know, such that any single particle is maximally entangled with the rest, or as entangled as it can be. Okay. So you want locally maximally mixed marginals, and you could, you know, maybe think of this as a quantum version of a stochastic tensor, if you wished. Sort of triply quantum, doubly stochastic. Well, I guess triply stochastic. Quantum triply stochastic. Sounds nice. Right. And again, this problem depends only on the eigenvalues because, you know, the unitary group is part of GL, so we can always change base for free. Now, here's sort of a nice way of encoding the solution to this problem. Let's take our favorite quantum state X, pure state X, look at all these scalings as well as their limits, and let's compute the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrices. So if all the local dimensions are n and I have d particles, this would be a vector on r to the dn, right? R to the n plus n, d times. So that's some object. If I take limits here, it's a closed object. And magically, it turns out to be a convex polytope, always, okay? And for example, if I take as my reference state the GG state, then it turns out I get the same polytope I got before. So any one particle data can be explained by belonging to the GG state or to its closure. That's actually no surprise here because you can get approximate any state to arbitrary precision by a GG, by something in the, you know, equivalent to a GG state. What's interesting and also well known is sort of if you look at the W state, then this is no longer the case. So there's no way of taking a W state, applying SLOCC to it, and getting arbitrarily close to this origin, which corresponds to a situation where all the reduced density matrices are maximally mixed, all the one-body reduced density matrices are maximally mixed. So there's a difference, but again, it's a polytope, but it's a smaller polytope, okay? And so as I was saying, that's always true. You could sort of, I mean, if you like, you could sort of, I mean, we call these things entanglement polytopes at some point because they encode sort of, you know, all you can see from the single particle level about this SLOCC entanglement class, okay? There's other motivations why you might want to look at them. It turns out that actually sort of in the sort of algebraic complexity sort of tensor community, people are really interested in tensor ranks. So I defined at the very beginning of the talk what the rank of a tensor is, but that's only one possible definition. There's many other ones, the analytic rank, geometric rank, slice rank, all these things. So there's two objects in particular. One is known as the quantum functional. I think there was a QRP talk about this a few years back by Jeroen Saudam and Matthias Kostandl and Peter Ferner. So this thing, actually, the object they define is actually something that you obtain by optimizing about this polytope. So it's a rank, it's like a number that you associate to a tensor, but it's actually just sort of an entropy maximization over this polytope, okay? And more recently, there's also nice work by Harm Dirksen, who defined the notion of a G-stable rank. Again, this is an object that sort of a numerical quantity you can extract from this entanglement polytopes. And so these are really sort of interesting, you know, lower bounds on tensor ranks, upper bounds on subranks that are sort of useful in sort of algebraic complexity theory world. And so, you know, it begs the question and motivates why that we would like to solve this question. Okay, so we would really like to solve this tensor scaling problem and characterize these polytopes. Okay. The sad sort of news is that going about this naively is probably not going to be fruitful, because we know that, you know, even for three parties, so say for n by n tensors, right, polynomially large space in n, actually these polytopes can develop an exponential number of faces as well as vertices. So the right solution is not to write all of them down, but maybe the right solution is to phrase sort of the characterization of this polytope as an algorithmic question, as a computation question. So, you know, asking basically this problem that we stated here, you know, given say lambda 1 to lambda d, these, you know, vectors with say n elements, are they in the polytope or not? That is, you know, can they arise by tensor scaling or not? And that's kind of the question. And it's, in some sense, I personally feel, you know, without sort of great evidence, that in some sense this is representative for the general class of problems here. It's basically because in all of the previous problems there's very lucky coincidences and they fail for tensors. So that's why I think sort of there's a lot to be learned by studying tensors. Okay. And so what we do is basically we sort of provide sort of via this connection optimization theory algorithmic solutions. Sometimes they're efficient, sometimes they're not. For tensors, they are not yet polynomial time in all parameters, so that's still open. There's some complexity results. For example, we know that for this marginal problem itself, so for the biggest of all these polytopes, we know it's the membership problem is an NP and co-NP, so it's probably not hard. So that sort of makes us hope that maybe even for a single, for a fixed tensor X, deciding membership may be tractable. And so that's the ambition. Okay. So maybe
roughly 10 minutes left. Just to
give it a heads up. Thanks. So what I want to do in the last 10 minutes is to show you this algorithm sort of just right now for tensors. So I mean it's going to look incredibly simple, and then we'll think a bit about how it fits to the bigger picture and why it should work. Okay. And then I'll call it a day, and I guess for you it's also getting late in the workday. Great. So here's the algorithm. And so I'll focus on the tensor situation. I'll focus on three tensors for simplicity, and I'll focus on the simplest problem. Can I transform a given state or tensor into another one by SLOCC that has uniform marginals? Okay, so I want that at the end, the reduced centimeter is a proportion to the identity. That is the eigenvalue, the vector of eigenvalues should be proportional to the all ones vector. So that's some of the simplest instance of this problem. Okay, and here's the algorithm. Okay, so you just do t steps that all look the same, starting with your tensor x. You compute the marginals. If you're epsilon close to being uniform, you call it a day. If not, you apply one step, and it's the same step all the time. You look at the current reduced density matrices, row 1 to row 2, row 3. You compute that traceless part, and you basically make sort of I'll call this a gradient step for unclear reasons. You exponentiate this matrix multiplied with a small step size eta. Okay, so eta is some small constant. So this matrix is very close to the identity. It's basically 1 minus eta times row 1 traceless. You apply this to y, and you repeat. Okay, so in this tensor, it will become non-normalized usually, right, by doing these steps. I will always compute the marginals, these quantum marginals, these reduced density matrices, I always take to be trace one. I always normalize them just for my sanity. Okay. So that's the algorithm. Okay. This is obviously a scaling, right? It's a tensor product. It even has one parenthesis too much. Okay. So it's a really good scaling. And the theorem is that this works. Okay. So in the case that this problem can be solved for any epsilon, so in the case when a quantum approximate scaling exists with margins that are arbitrarily close to uniform, this algorithm works, and it finds one in time poly one over epsilon being this precision that you want, and input size, you know, the, sort of the numbers in your tensor, and say in binary, numerator, denominator, real complex part separately. And while I stated this for uniform marginals, it works. You can sort of easily generalize to arbitrary marginals, arbitrary eigenvalues, to higher rank tensors, to tensor with symmetry, so yeah, anti-symmetry. If your tensor is, you know, say an MPS, then of course it will stay an MPS by SLOCC. So I would be really interested in applying this, say, in some many-body situations and sort of, you know, probing our whether these marginal problem constraints are relevant. You know, in some sense, well, this is sort of a non-unitary operation, but you could in principle implement by, you know, sort of some of the standard quantum algorithm techniques that we know. We don't yet know how to do this in a nice way. That's something we're thinking about currently. And you can also solve this marginal problem once you have such a result. Okay. Now in the marginal problem, there was no starting tensor X, right? Not because the tensor scaling problem start with X, I want to get from X somewhere else. In the marginal problem, there's no input state. It's just about what is possible, right? When does there exist a state with my favorite marginals? Turns out you can solve the problem by just starting with a random state X. Okay. So that's the algorithm. Any syntax questions and any typos that you? Okay. So why does it work? Okay. So of course the whole thing has to connect to our general framework. There has to be a norm. We want to minimize the norm. There should be a gradient. There should be connected to all the things. Okay. So let's look at this real quick. So a crucial step in the algorithm is this one, right? Where we apply this little exponential. Okay. Now, what's going to be the norm that we look at, right? What's a group action? So group action will be the following. We'll act by products, tensor products of determinant one matrices. And so that will be our group, tuples of determinant one matrices. We have our starting tensor X, and the norm that we want to minimize is the norm of, you know, X after having applied this invertible local operation across A1 to A2 and to A3. So that's our norm function. Same kind of norm function we studied at the beginning in complete generality. And I claim it has something to do with this problem. Okay. And the connection is that the gradient of this function can actually exactly be identified with the traces parts of the reduced density matrices. So what does it mean to look at the gradient? Well, the gradient is the vector whose components are the direction derivatives. So let's look at direction derivatives. So how do we get directions in SL? We know that any matrix of determinant one can be written as the exponential of a traceless matrix, okay? So if I fix my favorite three traceless matrix, H1, H2, H3, they actually determine a direction in the space of determinant one matrices. And I can write down a little curve, e to the TH1, e to the TH2, e to the TH3. That's a curve in the space of triplets of determinant one matrices. And now the direction derivative in this direction is just, well, the derivative at t equals zero, for example, of this object. Of this curve, the norm evaluated along this curve. So that's a direction derivative on the manifold, really. And if you do the very simple math, what you will find out, modulo some things asserted on the rug, is basically that what you find is exactly the trace between the trace inner product, the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product between the traces part of the first reduced density matrix and H1, plus the same second H2, and so on and so forth. Okay, maybe there's some factors of two around that I've ignored. So okay, what do we find? We find that the direction derivative of direct H1, H2, H3 is exactly dual to this triple of reduced density matrices after subtracting the traces part, right? Because if you take the inner product between this triple and this triple, that's exactly computed like so with respect to the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product. In other words, the gradient should be this triple of traces matrices, the traces parts of the marginals. And now we see that setting the gradient to zero is of course exactly solving our problem. Because if the gradient is zero, it means the reduced density matrices have no traceless part. It means they're all proportioned to the identity matrix. Okay, so that's, I guess, the punchline that I just stole. So point is, minimizing the gradient is exactly what we want. But on the other hand, what are we doing here? Well, what we're doing here is actually taking a little step in the direction given by row 1, 0, row 2, 0, row 3, traceless. In other words, this is really doing a little gradient descent step in the direction corresponding, well, to this gradient, right? So it's the same, this is the same, you know, formula as this thing for t equals minus eta. So it's doing a negative gradient step, it's a gradient descent step for some fixed step eta. And that's the point, okay? So that's why it should work. And I guess I have 2 plus epsilon minutes. So the task now is to make this quantitative, right? So this sort of in a hand-wavy fashion maybe tells you why something should be fine. And you remember at the beginning that I told you that minimizing norms is equivalent to minimizing gradients. So that should work, but how do we get a time bound? Okay, we have someone have to show that you make progress each time and so on. So that's what one would have to do. So we'll probably skip this part, but I just wanna come back to what I said. So at the very beginning, we set this, like, you know, grand sort of framework, we had a group action vector, and we were trying to minimize its norm. So we were studying this norm function. At that point, I asserted to you that it's equivalent, minimizing the norm is equivalent to setting the gradient to zero. That is to minimizing the gradient. So in general, that's not true. I mean, for general functions, setting the gradient to zero is necessary, but not sufficient for minimizing the function. Here it turns out to be equivalent, okay, as we just said. Again, this is this norm minimization problem. This is the problem we call the scaling problem. And now we understand why, right? Because it's literally the matrix or operator or tensor scaling problem in these examples, the problem of setting these reduced tensor matrices to zero. So we saw now in three examples that this gradient, or say in two and for one, I just told you, that computing this gradient is exactly computing these kinds of marginals, you know, row sums, column sums, reduced density matrices, whatnot. Okay. And okay, there's nice things one can say about this duality. It sort of generalizes linear programming duality to sort of non-commutative groups, if you wish. And sort of the point of our paper was basically to, for this general problem, make this duality quantitative, right? So basically understanding, you know, how close do you have to be the optimum on one side in order to solve the tensor scaling or marginal problem to some precision and so on. And to sort of write down first and second order methods. So first order method would be something like this gradient descent that I mentioned. Second order method would be one that also uses the Hessian, okay? And sort of all these examples, you know, in one way or another fall into this framework. And sometimes, you know, we can solve now these problems efficiently. Sometimes we can do it at least efficiently, you know, for fixed parameters, like if the precision epsilon is fixed. And so that's quite nice. And you can also solve this null cone problem, so this very algebraic one that I mentioned before, if you like. Okay, so I think I'll sort of skip sort of everything except for the conclusion slide. You may be curious why it is true that, you know, these two things are equivalent. Usually, you know, as we were saying, minimizing a function is not the same as setting the gradient to zero. The one case where we know it's the same is when our function is convex. Okay, then usually convex functions have this nice property. And it turns out that here, this norm function is secretly also convex. Now it's not clear what convexity should mean on a group, right? Because a group is not a Euclidean space. So we don't know what it means to be convex. But what we do know is we have sort of nice curves. I'll respond to Anurag in a moment. We have sort of nice curves in our group given by, you know, e to the t h. So this is exactly what we did here, right? We have these nice sort of curves. They turn out to be geodesics in the group. So they are very natural things to look at. And it turns out that this norm function is actually convex as a function of this parameter t. So along any curve. So, right, so you have this group, you know, homogeneous space, if you are more picky. So you have the group, you look at sort of a geodesic in this group of this form. Then it turns out that this norm function is even log convex along this line. Okay. And that's enough sort of for all the good things. And one can make this quantitative, one can prove lower and upper bounds, all the things. In general, the function is not strongly convex with regards to Anurag's question. In some results, there's some nice analyses where one can show that, you know, typical starting points are strongly convex to some extent. So that's very interesting sort of recent and ongoing work. But sort of to analyze this gradient descent in the simplest case here, right, to get this 1/ε convergence, kind of you don't need strong convexity. It's sort of enough to know an upper bound on the Hessian. That's all, okay. So one can analyze the algorithm. Basically, it's clear you have to show you make progress at each step and you have to know an upper and a lower bound. That's sort of how it goes. There's some nice invariant theory involved in it, which you can ask me about. But with this, I want to conclude. So the point was, I tried sort of to give you a flavor of this, class of optimization problems over typically non-commutative groups. They encoded sort of various sort of marginal scaling problems that some of us would like to solve. On the optimization side, they amount to optimizing norms over group orbits, minimizing norms over group orbits, and sort of, you know, quite some generality. On the algebraic side, it's related to null cone and, you know, sort of looking at invariants, sort of certain quotients that are known in invariant theory. The sort of main quantum application, quantum information application, I think right now is sort of this quantum Martian connection. And then in particular, I think this connection to tensor ranks and maybe having numerical algorithms that can actually compute these new notions of ranks is very striking, interesting to me, okay. And it's kind of a cool set of techniques, I think, that comes together. So we would really like to be more efficient, okay? We would like to develop better tools for geodesic convex optimization, which is much less well-developed than ordinary convex optimization. some people in the audience are working together. Well, we're all sort of working together on these class of problems. We're currently looking into quantum algorithms as well, which I think is interesting, right? Because the objects of interest are naturally quantum states as well in many cases. And then it's sort of interesting, you know, what if our tensors are special or structured like this in complexity theory as well as in quantum information? There's of course sort of special classes of tensors that are known, and it would be nice, right? So for example, for a ground state, maybe things are much nicer, right? Maybe for an MPS, sort of these parameters are much better than the worst case. And then, you know, sort of how does it all tie in with sort of symmetries in general? Yeah, so sorry for running over time a little bit, and thanks very much for sticking around and for listening.
Thanks a lot, Michael. It was a really great talk. Do we have any questions for Michael? There are some claps from the participants. I don't know if you saw that.
I did, yeah. I appreciate it. Thanks.
I had a quick question. A very basic one. Hey, Michael, thanks for the great talk. So you described this gradient descent kind of algorithm in the later half of the talk. In the beginning, you talked about this scaling algorithm, right, where you do alternate scaling. Was there a reason why you put both of them in the same talk? Like, are they connected, or it was just?
Very good. Yeah, very good. Yeah, exactly. I think that's a good point. Yeah. It turns out that actually what this alternating minimization algorithm. So, two comments. One is you could also approach the tensor problem by an alternating minimization algorithm. That's actually something that Frank Verstraete proposed many, many years ago in this uniform case. And we analyzed this with Raphael and the others in the previous work. The thing is that this algorithm does not generalize to say symmetric tensors, you know, like more general situations. So that's why we like now these gradient descent style methods and also the second order methods, which give better guarantees. But it is true that, for example, I guess I phrase things in terms of the permanent here, but really it's all about the norm. So there's a way of like completely equivalently phrasing this, analysis where you actually show that, you know, with respect to a different normalization of all the objects involved, actually the norm is being minimized. So here, right, so the way I'm phrasing things, I'm sort of keeping the matrix normalized to the dimension all the time, because the row sums all equal to one, right? So the sum of all entries is n. You could also choose a different normalization, but you always want to, where you just care about the row and column sums being proportional to the all one vectors, to the all ones vector. And in that case, it's convenient to fix these scaling matrices, the left, these A's and the B's of determinant one. If you do this, just like in the tensor case, actually it turns out you're exactly minimizing the norm. And the only point is that in this alternating minimization algorithm, you have you have sort of two variables, the left and the right scalings. And you're just fixing the right scalings, you minimize the norm for the left scalings, and you can just do this in a single step. And that's actually what basically this row normalization does. It turns out that if you fix the B's and you're trying to minimize the, say, the L1 norm of this matrix over all A's that have determinant one, that's exactly being solved by setting them all to be the same. And that's basically by the arithmetic geometric mean inequality in disguise. So it's intimately related. I did a bad job. I should have sort of made this much more clear. And there was a hint, right? Because I said sort of the gradient of this norm function is really computing the row and the column sums. So right. So by setting the gradient to zero, because we know that's the same as minimize the function. So we knew that even this algorithm, if it achieved its goal, actually had to minimize the norm in the orbit because of these two problems being equivalent.
Right. Thanks a lot. I see.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess I'm going overboard with the answer, but the last point I want to make is that, you know, sort of the synchron algorithm is no longer sort of the state of the art in general, sort of especially with respect to the scaling with the target precision. And so the sort of the state of the art algorithms, in some sense, optimize exactly this norm in disguise. So these are algorithms by Raphael and co-authors and also other works by Cohen et al. And they use, you know, like sort of more fancy methods, sort of second order methods that they've developed, or first and second order methods and interior point methods and so on. But it's all about the minimizing the norm in a sense. And we would really like to have these algorithms in a non-commutative case and their guarantees.
Cool. Thanks so much.
Sure.
I have a probably very general question, but I'm still somewhat interested in it. Is there a way to make all of this or like a similar theory work for large but finite groups?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it's a great question. I mean, sort of, so naively, right, you would say, oh, this whole continuous approach somehow should like just blatantly fail. Right. On the other hand, there are some interesting, so there are also algebraic algorithms, for example, for finding perfect matchings on the one hand side, or say in this operator scaling part, basically deciding this problem, you know, the yes-no problem algebraically. And they sort of find, you know, what's called a Hall blocker in the matrix case, or sort of what's called a shrunk subspace in this case. So basically a subspace that gets compressed by all these Xi's jointly. And I feel, but I don't know how to make this precise, that sort of what these algebraic algorithms find is very similar to sort of the asymptotic behavior of these continuous algorithms, which maybe suggests that there could be some more general correspondence. I mean, I shouldn't even say this in a tape talk because it's sort of, it's just an idea, but I think maybe nice, yeah. I think maybe if operator scaling, maybe I know how to make this more precise, but in general, I don't know. I mean, we don't know algebraic algorithms that are sort of a similar flavor, say for tensors. But that's very interesting. I mean, also sort of, that's interesting for many reasons also because say, you know, these tensor ranks you can study over any field. And it would be, it's a big open problem, at least, you know, sort of to my friends and me, whether one can sort of generalize, you know, to which extent all these like different notions of ranks can be generalized to finite fields. So for example, in this recent work by Dirksen, he shows how to do this. And there's actually very beautiful ways sort of this. So there's this field called geometric invariant theory, which underlies all of these things. And this one also works over sort of certain kind of finite fields. So for one of these notions, it's known, but not for the other one, right? Because this other one is like basically computing entropies of like points, and we don't know what all these things mean. But that's a very nice question. I mean, it's sort of a one stumbling block is my lack of knowledge of sort of modular representation theory. But they're also sort of, I mean, yeah, there's nothing sort of naively continuous anymore. Yeah, it's a great question.
Cool. Thanks. Yeah, maybe in the interest of time and everyone's evening/night, we should conclude. So thanks again, Michael, for a great talk.